Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro. Show. They got me started, lying hearted. I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit gon' be televised. Black power, be scared guys, that be standing there like they paralyzed, ha. We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. If up the black police, that 13th Amendment. Tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free. Okay, Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here. Up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the counselor, the elder, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Boys that don't tolerate it, melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation, Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Liberation,
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Ron Daniels. I'm president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and convener of the National African American Reparations Commission. And I want to welcome you to this National Juneteenth Forum on Building a Culture of Repair, convened by the Global Circle for Reparations and Healing. First of all, happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there on Juneteenth Day. Yes. We have declared Juneteenth a day of reparations and healing. I know they got watermelon ice cream and all kinds of salads, and stuff, but we're not buying any of that. We are talking about reparations and healing. To begin the proceedings, it is my honor to bring to the podium the senior pastor of this historic church. And let me just say that 30 years ago, I was an independent candidate for president of the United States. In fact, somebody just walked up and told me that they voted for me. I appreciate your vote, brother. But I declared my candidacy for the president of the United States right here at the historic Shiloh Baptist Church. Yes. And so this church is a great church, a wonderful church, and we bring now the senior pastor of this historic church of worship, Reverend Dr. Wallace Charles Smith, for the welcome and the invocation. Please welcome him.
Dr. Daniels, a distinguished panel, I just want to welcome you to the Shiloh Baptist Church. We have worship service here this morning and have been celebrating all day. But this is an important occasion. This is the first, and all of you know this, I'm not saying anything you don't know, this is the first of the national celebrations of Juneteenth. And being here today is very important. It's an indication that we as people of color, but also goodwill, understand that we have to really work more and more to make sure that our issues are not swept away. That's been the case for much too long. And so we thank God for you, and we're glad that you're here today. And I know we're going to get some great information from this very distinguished panel. Let us pray. Lord God, we certainly thank you for this occasion. We thank you for this day. We thank you for this very special observance of this important date. Lord, it is just one of those tragedies of history that people in Texas had to wait 2 years before they found out that they were free, as unscrupulous planters and owners continued to benefit from their free labor, although for all of those 2 years they were free men and women. Lord, in that spirit, we pray for justice, we pray for equity, we pray for fairness. We thank you for visiting us today and helping us to think clearly about what we must do if we're going to continue the pathways of freedom. Amen.
You're quite welcome, Doc.
Okay. And so now, in the African tradition, we'd like to invite the ancestors to join us. So for those who are able and willing, would you please stand? For those of you who are able and willing, if you don't have to, if you don't want to, and if you're... And we're going to be assisted by Minister Christian Watkins. In the African tradition, libations are poured because the African worldview is based on the notion that we not only are born, we of course die, but we continue in a ceaseless cycle of birth and death and resurrection. In the African worldview, there is the notion that we can invite our ancestors to be with us, to both bless us and to be among us, as long as we utter their names. Nomo, the African word for the word. And when we utter their names, we bring them in to our gatherings and to our midst. And they are able to be with us and to guide us and to bless us and to empower us. And there are many, many different ways that libations are poured throughout the African continent. And so we just sort of synchronize a way of doing it. And so in a very abbreviated way, we are going to do it today. I'll say a few words, and then I'm going to invite you to participate in the process by joining it. We begin by saying that we understand that we are an African people, that we are the creators of all of civilization, that all of humankind flows from out of Africa, from the womb of an African woman, indeed. That we are the givers of life and civilization, the great inventions that helped to create civilization, and we created great universities and great institutions. We are not a servile people. We are the original givers of life and civilization. And for that, we say Ashe. There came a time, however, in our life, the life and times of our great people, when there was an intrusion. We called it the Maafa, the African Holocaust, where intruders from another world, another planet, not another planet, another part of the world, intervened into Africa. And in so doing, utilizing weapons that we had not seen before and weapons that we were not capable of resisting to some extent, captured us. They captured us. But they did not capture us without resistance, because at every step, Africans resisted. Whether it was Queen Nzinga and Shaka Zulu and others, we fought. We struggled. We resisted the conquest. And for all of those who fought and struggled and fought for our redemption and our salvation, let us say Ashe. We went to those dread castles that many of you have visited. And we were sent across the ocean, not knowing whether we would ever see our homeland again. But even then, in the Christian terms, there were some who said, before I be a slave, I be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. People resisted on the ships. They fought on the ships. And some actually dove overboard, knowing that we as an African people come back again and again and again. For those whose bodies are buried that yet have risen from the ocean, let us say Ashe. On into this hemisphere we came to actually build, even as we were enslaved, even as they tried to strip us of our identity, even as they tried to strip us and to have us believe that our blackness was inferior, we did not believe. And so we went even into places like Jamaica and throughout Central and South America, and we created communities, maroon communities, where we fought back, communities so strong that in many instances the Europeans would not touch them. They negotiated treaties with our folk, because as an African people we have that sense of resilience. And yet others were conquered because of the superiority of the weaponry and the disorientation of being away. And so for all of those who were enslaved and whose wealth was extracted, we say Ashe. We also say Ashe for those who resisted, and among them the Haitian Revolution, the greatest revolution the world has ever seen, led by the voodoo priest Boukman, who prayed to the African God. He said, the white man's God we do not understand, but the black man's God and woman's God is a righteous God. And so it was Boukman and Waka Aima who gave the spiritual power. We know about Toussaint Louverture. We know about Dessalines. We know, but we need to know about Boukman, because it was the spiritual power of Boukman who gave the Haitian revolutionaries from all over the Caribbean the power to achieve one of the greatest victories in the history of humankind. They defeated the French and sent them back packing to France, and they created an independent nation. For them, we say Ashe. And throughout the hemisphere, we know, even into the Americas, we were enslaved, yet we created as we enslaved. We created music. We found ways to be up in the master's face and say, steal away to Jesus. And they thought we were just talking about Jesus. We were talking about resisting, because we be a creative people. And we fought back. Denmark Basie, Tucson Lover, Denmark Basie, Nat Turner, rebellion after rebellion after rebellion we fought. For all of those slave rebellions, let us say, Ashe. And on to after emancipation, no 40 acres and a mule, but nonetheless, we fought to unify our families. A part of why we gather today is because there was the brutalization of our families and our women and our children. And yet, upon the emancipation, we went looking for our children. We wanted to reunite our families and try to find a way to make a way out of no way, and we did that. And for those who were not enslaved, they created institutions like the African Methodist Episcopal Church and other independent institutions, because that's who we are as an African people, for those who resisted in those ways, let us say, Ashe. And on into the 21st century, whether it's the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, whether it is Queen Mother Moore, and on into or Elhaj Malik El Shabazz, into the 21st century, we have been fighting and building and resisting and creating for ourselves in the middle of this hostile, racist, white supremacist infected system. We have survived, as Maya Angelou says, and still we rise, and still we rise, and still we will continue to rise. And so shout out the names of, you know, there's Fannie Lou Hamer, and there's all the different people that you could shout out. I invite you to shout out the name of your heroes and sheroes, and say out the names of your families. Shout out their names. 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 Let them bring them to shout out their names. And now we have a moment of silence. The last pouring of the water, Ashe. I've been invited the ancestors in. You may all be seated now. Quickly, the occasion that brings us here, and we're so happy that you're all here. There are so many Juneteenth celebrations taking place. Someone said today it's not necessarily about celebration, it's about acknowledgement. It's about really knowing from whence we've come and knowing our history, and all of that will be a part of the program today and all of these programs. Look at these two beautiful young children in the front row. They're soaking it up. Let's give them a big round of applause for being here. And so what we have done is we've brought together an extraordinary assembly of reparations advocates and healers who are coming to you to remind America and the world, because we must never, ever forget. So we remind America and the world of the harms, of the injuries inflicted on our people across this country, African descendants in the U.S., and across the world over centuries through the Maafa. We are also here, however, to talk about the resilience and the resistance and the building of our people. We want to talk today about the status of what Professor Hilary Beckles has called the human rights movement of the 21st century, reparations. That reparations is the human rights struggle of the 21st century. What Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has said, that only reparations gets at the heart of structural institutional racism, that there can be no more perfect union unless there is reparations. So we'll be talking about the status of H.R. 40. We'll be talking about other forms of healing that are taking place. And we want to talk about how we create reparative systems, because at the end of the day, we don't want to create systems that replicate the damage and the harm, the values that created this capitalist political economy that has destroyed so many people. We want to figure out how we avoid that. And then finally, we want to hear from you in the audience, an opportunity to hear your suggestions and your ideas, having heard the conversation. So that's our purpose. That is what we'll be doing today. Let me just quickly say that among the organizations that are a part of the global circle of reparations and healing are the Africa Transitional Justice Legacy Fund, the Black Parent Initiative, Community Healing Network, Decolonizing Wealth Project, FARMS, Global Black Diaspora Rising, the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, Dr. Joy DeGruy Productions, JDP Incorporated, Jubilee Justice, LWC Studios, Incobra, NBCI Trust, Ready Nationwide, Safe Black Space, Spirit House Incorporated, the Africa America Institute, AAI, Federation of Southern Farms Cooperatives, Atlanta Assistance Fund, the Grassroots Reparations Campaign, Telling Truth Project, and Kingdom Branding. Give them all a big round of applause. And so now, to get our program started at another level, we want to invite in by recorded message the woman who has inherited a torch from the Honorable John Conyers. John Conyers, at the behest of Incobra, at the behest of a figure, and that's why you have to shout out these names. Reparation Ray Jenkins. People may not know him, but Reparations Ray Jenkins was one strong African freedom fighter who kept going to Congressman John Conyers and saying, we got to do something about reparations. We got to do something about reparations. Because of that, and because John Conyers is who he was, one of the greatest progressive legislators in the history of this country. Let's give it up for John Conyers. Tremendous legislator. The Martin Luther King bill is because of John Conyers, because he fought for it and never gave up. But the woman who has inherited a torch from him and fights in his legacy is out of Houston, Texas. In fact, she is the person who introduced initially the concept of Juneteenth that was embraced last year. She is the woman who is on the Judiciary Committee, but she's the lead sponsor of H.R. 40, courageous, visionary. You see her all the time championing all kinds of causes. I don't know where she gets all that energy from, but she is energetic. She is very dynamic. She's the one who leads us in this struggle for H.R. 40. We now invite in the Honorable Sheila Jackson Lee.
Hello, I'm Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. How powerful today is building a culture of repair, the global circle of reparations and healing. Hello to my friends, and particularly the friends of the Why We Can't Wait Coalition, who have been working for now 90 months to be part of this great program and be part of the world discussion, the nation's discussion, on not only Juneteenth, but H.R. 40, the Commission to Study Slavery and Reparations. How do they intertwine? I was so glad to be the first member of Congress to introduce the legislation to create the Juneteenth federal holiday, having done the resolutions for almost a decade. Even this week, I introduced a resolution just to make sure that the record of Congress had the acknowledgement of Juneteenth. Juneteenth established in 1865. It was the time that General Granger arrived 2 years late after the proclamation emancipation that freed the slaves. But west of the Mississippi, the slaves still worked. General Granger came on the shores of Galveston, and the life of those slaves who had been the beast of burden, who had not been compensated, who had not been respected, who had not allowed families to be united. And there they were, listening with a band of just an amazing amount of expectation. And this is what we do today in this forum. Their expectation was for goodness and for what was right. But as General Granger read that order said that you, the slaves, are now free. You can continue your manual labor. And in fact, you now don't have to leave. You can be part of an employer-employee relationship with your master. I would argue that many of the slaves there who were there with expectation may not have understood the word employer-employee, because that means compensation, life insurance, workman's comp, time off. That did not happen with slavery. And so these slaves looked, as I said, with expectation. And they began to understand the word freedom. And if you look up Reedy Chapel, the oldest church there, the slave church, they in fact began to march and to leave to their freedom. They know what employee meant, but they knew what freedom meant. And so as we begin to capture the reparations and the healing, think about freedom. Juneteenth is the first H.R. 40 to study slavery and develop reparation proposals, which we have been advocating for because it addressed the disparities of the 21st century. And it looks at slavery, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. It looks at the actions of Hayne and the actions of the government in sanctioning horrors that happened. We do not look at this commission in anger. We look at it for the research and the capacity for repair and restoration. And that is what I know that you will discuss today, as well as the outstanding speakers that you will have will talk about the economic disparities, $17,000 for a black family to $171,000 for a white family, the disparities in criminal justice, disparities in housing. But as I close, let me be very clear. We in America, we love freedom. We don't want the ills. And what we are hoping to repair is to fix the government-sanctioned discrimination. And so we are pushing an executive order based upon the foundation of almost 217 congressional co-sponsors. We want the White House to collaborate with us on an executive order to bring that harmony to this nation, to understand those who fought in civil wars and wars beyond, who died and shed their blood, law enforcement, first responders who are, in fact, from this community. Happy Juneteenth, but it is somber in recognizing that it was the freeing of slaves. And it is my humble appreciation to salute you for this conference today. Happy Juneteenth, and let us pass H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals.
The Honorable Sheila Jackson Lee, and she's on a mission. And by the way, executive order, we have piled up the people on this stage who have worked to build more co-sponsors than ever before in the history of this bill. We know that it will not get through the Senate. Everybody knows the drill. Y'all know what the deal is. You can't get nothing through the Senate. And so it can be done by executive order. We had really asked Biden to do it by today, but if not today, we want a sign, we want a signal of when, because we can't wait any longer. We ain't waiting no longer, because we have waited all these many years. Our ancestors scream out for reparatory justice. One of the people who has that we know has talked about the damages and the harm that has been inflicted not only to our ancestors, but that flows unfortunately across generations. That the science now tells us that the damages, the harm is in our genes, that it is passed on from generation to generation. This is one of the reasons why we were susceptible more than anybody else to COVID, frankly. But one of the persons who came onto the scene with the notion of post-traumatic slavery syndrome, took it by storm, took it, fired everybody up to understand it, was Dr. Joy DeGruy, who now joins us by recorded message.
Hello, my name is Dr. Joy DeGruy, and I am very pleased to be with you today on Juneteenth. I am honored to be part of this commemoration. I'm only sorry I cannot be there with you in person. The work that myself and a number of individuals and groups literally around the world are engaged in are around issues of healing and reparations. My work is around healing principally, and I think there is a little mythology around what is required with healing, as though healing can occur outside of justice. And so these are things that go hand in hand. And part of what my group is doing, my team of folks, is we're doing something called the Be the Healing Symposiums. We've done four of them in major cities across the United States, and we have one remaining that we will be doing in Atlanta at the end of this month. These are two-day symposiums open free to the public as a result of a generous grant from the MacArthur Foundation. And what we've been able to do in these 2 days in this symposium is really create a love fest. And the first day of the symposium is really committed to educating people, helping folks understand systemic racism, historical trauma, and contemporary trauma, and how that has weighed on us and how that's showing up in our minds and our hearts and our bodies and our spirits. And the goal here is to help people understand the nature of the injury, because you can't heal what you don't understand. And so following that rather thick and lengthy presentation, we have breakout sessions, and I have trained facilitators that are there to manage any kind of triggering that may happen as a result of this very, very weighty information, but also to have a conversation, to break into groups and talk about how they're seeing themselves being able to use this information, how it's showing up inside of their minds. What do they want to do? What do they want to change as they move forward? These are the kinds of questions that we put forth. And day two of the symposium is really committed totally to healing. And the focus of this is a solution-oriented kind of lens. And we're looking at what are some of the practical things that we can learn? What are the improvement strategies that we can employ? What are we doing with our children and our communities? How can we hold schools and other institutions accountable? All of this becomes part of those healing strategies. The goal, of course, is to ensure that there is continuous growth and improvement, and that it's sustainable healing, so that we, one, understand, so we can begin to look at the residual impacts of all of these generations of trauma, starting, of course, with American chattel slavery, and then also taking a look at what are some of the contemporary traumas that we continue to experience as a result of anti-blackness and racial terrorism. And so I believe that the symposiums, and thus far we've had an incredible response, pre and post surveys, to kind of figure out where people start, where they are, where they want to go. And that has all been quite positive and encouraging and exciting. We've also had youth panels that have come in and talked to us about what's going on with them and how they are experiencing this time, this very, very intense time, as you know. And clearly the assault has not stopped. So we need to really be pragmatic about what we're doing in our homes and with our families and with our community. So to that end, I think that the other piece that's important for people to understand about Juneteenth, and of course I know my fellow scholars and my incredible brothers and sisters that are putting this on have really showed you and made the case for understanding why it's important to understand Juneteenth. But I want to talk a little bit about some mythology around slavery. And so part of what happened is we have this belief that slavery ended and, I don't know, somehow the playing field got leveled and everything was fine. Well, the first thing that happened is it didn't end. We had peonage. And this is really important to recognize how the past impacts the present. So we're looking at how the residual impacts of slavery show up with peonage, unlawful selling of people back into slavery. And by the way, we never got the 40 acres or the mule. Okay, that never happened. Then we had black codes. Freed blacks were still not welcome. So they had sundown laws and black codes and exclusionary acts, official and unofficial. Then we had, you know, folks forced. You want to know where mass incarceration started? It started with convict leasing, because they wanted to have that cheaper labor force, so they started arresting black folks for loitering 15 years for startling a white woman, looking menacingly at a white woman. Right? So these things were big business then. It sustained white communities and white people, but it does today. And we don't even realize how many industries, how many organizations to this date are really still utilizing and exploiting prison labor. So that's happening to this day. So when we start looking at our displacement consistent with slavery, segregation, redlining, urban renewal and now gentrification, right? So what we're looking at is a process of behaviors and laws that have consistently terrorized us. And so what we need to do is first understand. First it is to know, and then it is to do. You cannot heal what you don't understand. And believe me, this is not something that can happen in a lab or in a clinic where we sit down. We're not broken people. We are people that have been and continually are assaulted. And we've got to, number one, stop that assault, prevent the future harm of our children. And then we have to ensure a continuous improvement. We have to ensure that there is sustained healing, sustained well-being. That's what this work is all about. That's what my work is all about, is to make sure that I can look in the faces of young people and say to them as their elder, I got you. I got you. So what I want to say in closing is I love you all. I know we're in a real difficult time right now, but it's a pregnant time, and this too shall pass. And given what we've experienced, I know we got this moving forward. So I want you to be safe, to be well, and to be the healing. Thank you so very much.
All right, Dr. Joy DeGruy, if you will. And that was what we call a framing presentation around the notion of healing. And one of the things that she talked about was people don't associate necessarily reparations with something like gentrification. But I think I may have mentioned at the beginning or somewhere along the line, it is reparations are for enslavement, yes, but all of the legacies. And one of the things I've been thinking about, even in terms of a city like Washington, D.C., we sometimes, and I've been guilty of this sometimes, talking about accomplishments and what we should do and what we ain't doing and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, when you look at urban renewal, the Negro removal program, we called it of the 20th century, prosperous black communities like Buffalo, the southeast side of Buffalo, I may be saying the wrong side of town, but I think it's what that's in Buffalo. The east side, they shot, and you just came from there, they shot right up through the middle of that city, that town, dividing us. And then when you look at a city like Washington, D.C., the last colony, and not the one of the last colonies, we have to remember Puerto Rico and so forth and so on, but this is like, does not have its independence. It was once Chocolate City. It was not Chocolate City no more. Because of the displacement of black people and black culture. So we have to also, that is also due reparations. That's right, give it up. So now we'd like to bring to the podium for a framing statement on the issue of reparations and healing, but more of an emphasis on reparations. A very, very dynamic, visionary, strong brother who's come up through the movement, mentored by many. He's emerging and has emerged really as a major thought leader and a major proponent and scholar, understanding reparations in all of its dimensions, particularly in terms of international law and its applications. He is none other than Cam Howard. Cam Howard is the former male chair of NCOBRA, a legacy organization. He now comes speaking for Reparations United. Would you please welcome Cam Howard?
Thank you, Dr. Daniels. And as Dr. Daniels stated, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee is an extraordinary leader for us in this, on this national fight to be repaired in this country. I want to welcome everyone to the Global Circle of Reparations and Healing Juneteenth program entitled Building a Culture of Repair. In my remarks, I want to invoke the memory and the teachings of our brilliant multi-genius ancestor, Dr. Sheik Anta Diop, who some refer to as Diop. Dr. Diop single-handedly defeated the entire Western academic world, proving that the pyramid builders of ancient Kemet, that they called Egypt, were as African as you and I. Dr. Diop used the disciplines of chemistry, utilizing the science of carbon dating, measuring the melanin and carbon content in the skin of the mummies. He utilized history, researching ancient records to see what the Kemetic people said about themselves and what contemporary writers who lived outside of Kemet were writing about them. He utilized linguistics and the etymology of words, learning the Kemetic language and linking it to modern-day African languages like those of his own language, Wolof, that's spoken all the way on the other side of the continent in the country of Senegal. He added to his proof utilizing anthropology and the origins of humanity and civilization and culture, and he even debunked their own ultra-racist field of Egyptology, again, mastering the ancient language of our ancestors. And he gave all of this multidisciplinary research to us in his book, Introduction to African Civilization. The title of that book was radical and revolutionary at the time because European academia was saying that Africa and Africans didn't have a history. In fact, they were saying we didn't even enter into history until they, the Europeans, came into Africa to civilize us. So we are here today talking about building a culture of repair because of their so-called civilization. And I want to say that again because I really want that to sink in today. We're talking about building a culture of repair because of their civilization. In one of Dr. Diop's other books called Civilization of Barbarism, he asks and answers the question scientifically of whether or not what we're experiencing today as civilization and high culture is really a complex and sophisticated system of structured barbarism. Among other things in his book, he says that a culture of a people, any people, is composed of three main components, because we're talking about building a culture of repair. So the culture of a people is composed of three main components: the collective consciousness of the people, the language of the people, and the ethos or spiritual, psychological component of the people. It's what Dr. Amos Wilson would call the collective personality of a people. And as we are here building this culture of repair, we too must focus on these three components of culture. First, collective consciousness. Collective consciousness is composed of the historical memory. What do the people know and think about their past, their present, and their future? Collective consciousness is the shared knowledge, understanding, and interpretation of a people's relationship to one another, to others, to the environment, to the world. For this conversation today on a culture of repair, what is the shared historical memory, the shared system of consciousness that we must build upon and what we are building upon in this movement in America? I refer to this shared consciousness as Reparations 1-2-3. At the World Conference Against Racism held in Durban, South Africa, the international community gave us a motto, a paradigm of thought and action from which we build our collective reparations consciousness upon. That motto is one, crimes were committed. The transatlantic slave trade, enslavement, apartheid, it was called Jim Crow in this country, were in fact crimes against humanity. They were not just immoral acts. They were crimes against humanity. So number one in reparations 1-2-3 is crimes were committed. Number two, injuries have resulted from those crimes. Wherever you see racial disparities, you see an injury resulting from those crimes. So number two in reparations 1-2-3 is injuries. And number three is just a logical deduction. If crimes were committed and injuries resulted, then repair is necessary. So one, crimes, two, injuries, three, repair. This model that we got from Durban is the basis of our collective consciousness on how we move in this country around the issue of reparations. That's what we build our shared understanding and knowledge upon as we continue to act to not only win reparations, but deliver reparative resources to our people. The second component of culture, or the culture of repair, is the language of repair. What's the language that we must be using today? It comes from that above model, crimes in America. There were three periods of crimes, the period of enslavement, period of Jim Crow segregation, and this neo-apartheid period that we're in today. The injuries was more than just the wealth gap. Don't let everybody, get you focused on the wealth gap. It's all the racial gaps and disparities resulting from anti-blackness, white supremacy, white nationalism, genocide, apartheid, and plunder. The third language is full reparations. It is necessary that we engage in as many projects, policies, and programs for as long as it's necessary to repair the developmental difficulties, differences, and disparities we experience. Full reparations is an international concept that has five components: cessation and guarantees of non-repetition, restitution and repatriation, compensation, satisfaction, and rehabilitation. A fourth concept that we must be using all the time is crimes against humanity, as I talked about. These are the most egregious crimes that a government can commit against a civilian population. And most importantly, crimes against humanity do not have a statute of limitation that bars us from how long we can bring this crime to justice. Number five, comprehensive eligibility. Eligibility has been debated around the country right now, and we get this term comprehensive from my sister Jam, who you're going to hear from later, but it flows effortlessly from the Durbin model. Whoever the crimes or harms were committed against, they or their descendants are eligible for redress for those specific crimes of those specific periods. These were complete systems of social control, and inherently all were affected either socially, economically, physically, emotionally, psychologically, or spiritually. There was no escaping. That's why the National African American Reparations Commission says all black people harmed in America should be repaired in America by America. So as we advance the movement, it's important that we are speaking the same language, the same reparation language to each other and to those who have harmed us. This brings us to our last component of building the culture of repair, the reparations ethos. I want to go back to Dr. Jope for a minute in his book, Civilization and Barbarism. Dr. Jope has what he called a two-cradle theory of civilization, where civilizations were birthed and nurtured. One cradle he calls the southern cradle, Africa. The other cradle is the northern cradle, Europe. When people first came together in these cradles, they developed a civilization out of the conditions of the environment they lived in. In the South, Africa, food was plentiful, not so in the North. The climate was pleasing in the South, not so in the North. Nature was giving, nurturing, nourishing, and abundant in the South, again, not so in the North. As a result, Dr. Jope says, a collective personality, particular to those cradles, were born. In the North, the ethos was warring and aggressive, xenophobic, which means the hatred of strangers, and hostile. In the South, it was communal, harmonious with nature, xenophilia, and welcoming. So in essence, as we are building our cultural repair, our ethos has to be one where we go back to the origins of our civilization, the origins of collectivism, communalism, and cooperativeness, utilizing the African people principle, the greatest good for the greatest number of African people. The ethos of tribalism that is taking place in the reparations movement now must not allow to flourish if we are truly going to build a culture of repair in America, a culture of repair in the world. So again, our ethos, our collective personality is one that says all black people harmed in America by America should be repaired in America by America. And by extension, all black people harmed by global anti-Africanists must be repaired wherever they are, regardless of their place of birth. Repair is determined by the place of injury. I'm Cam Howard of Reparations United, and we are the Global Circle of Reparations and Healing. Thank you.
All right, brother, you're allowed to drop the mic. Brilliant presentation as expected, and I'm going to tell you who's looking at what he's looking at and saying, Dr. Leonard Jeffries is looking at you, brother, he said, because you know Dr. Leonard Jeffries loves him from chair after Dion. Now we want to get into our panel discussion. We were going to hear a little bit of the sounds of blackness, but I'm trying to create a little bit more space to hear from our panel. And so what I'm going to do first is I want each of the panel to self-introduce themselves. So I'm going to start from... Boyd and Jam and Kichi Taifa and Dr. Malvo. You can self-introduce yourself, a little bit about your work, tight, crisp, but everybody know who you are. So Dr. Lloyd, you have the mic.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Dr.
Good afternoon. This is call and response, right? We among our people? Okay, I just want to be sure. Just want to check in.
Thank you for that. My name is Dr. John D. Lloyd. I am the Interim Executive Director for Community Healing Network. Community Healing Network is very excited and delighted to be a part of the Global Reparations Group here that you see today. And a little bit about what we do. We are on the healing side. We focus a lot of our work on healing and emotional reparation, really, is the way that we like to frame that. So healing from a very spiritual, psychological perspective. We're really trying to understand that and educate folks that there's a false narrative out there. There's this white lie that white people are superior and black people are inferior. That is completely false. And what we do through our work is we bring folks together in black-only spaces to talk about issues that impact us, impact our communities. And hopefully lift up people, make them feel good, make them feel that they're part of something, they're part of this change. We also have Ubuntu, rapid response circles, in which where there's some sort of racial crisis that's happening across this country and there's so many to pick and choose from, we have a team that goes out there in that community to work with folks on the ground to support that community. So I'll pause there and I'll pass it over.
Very much. All right. Jessica Ann Mitchell, also known as Jam. She be jamming, too.
I don't know if you all can hear me well. I'm Jessica Ann Mitchell. I woo your, but that's long, so we go with Jam. I'm the founder of the National Black Cultural Information Trust, where we share news, resources, and information that uplift the collective freedom of black communities, but also challenges cultural misinformation. One of the enduring harms of enslavement was erasure, where the identity of our ancestors was constantly pushed to be erased by these harmful systems because they knew that within the identity of our ancestors was strength. And that erasure is currently still going on. And it's also unfortunately infiltrating some parts of the reparation space. So what we do at NBCI Trust is push back on that and promote the narratives of our ancestors' full identities and cultures and everything that we as Black America are built on. And so just like yesterday, we go to different community events as well in the DMV. Yesterday we were giving out Juneteenth coloring books to children in Waldorf, Maryland, and also giving out different types of children's books that start at the Civil War or the Emancipation era all the way up until now. But that's just part of the work that we do, and we're just super excited to be a part of the Global Circle for Healing Reparation.
All right, Jam.
Greetings and salutations. Happy Juneteenth, Happy Father's Day, and reparations now.
All right.
My name is Nikichi Taifa. I'm an attorney, I'm an author, I'm a scholar, and I am an activist. I've been working on issues of reparations for over 50 years. Yes, 5 years. You know we don't crack. ever since I was a teenager selling Black Panther newspapers on the streets of Washington, D.C. I sat at the feet of many of the elders of reparations movement, many of whom are no longer with us but are with us on the ancestral plane, such as Queen Mother Moore, who started out with the Garvey movement, who's kept the issue of reparations alive throughout her entire life. Brother Imari Obadeli, Brother Chokwe Lumumba, these were folks that were part of the Black Power movement, which from which actually the modern day reparations movement sprang. I am a founding member, one of the founding members of NCOBA, the National Coalition of Black Reparations in America, founded in 1987, worked very closely with Congressman John Conyers in fashioning H.R. 40. I am an inaugural commissioner on NARC, the National African American Reparations Commission, and I am the director of the Reparation Education Project, which seeks to bring value to the broadening field of reparations. I have a TED Talk that I did several weeks ago. Please go to YouTube and pull up my name, or just pull up Reparations TED Talk, and you'll see a number of folks, but wait till you see my name. Okay, Nikichi Taifa. And I have a book that will be coming out very soon called Reparations on Fire, How and Why It's Spreading Across America. And in conclusion, in the appendix of that book will be the text of a book I co-authored in 1987 with Imari Obadeli and Chokwe Lumumba, both of whom are now ancestors, called Reparations Yes, the Legal and Political Reasons Why Our Ancestors Should Be Paid in Us for, I forgot, it's a long title. It was 1987. But I am reproducing the text of that book as part of the appendix of Reparations on Fire. Thank you very much.
Hi, Eva. All right.
Happy Sunday, y'all. I'm not going to say happy Juneteenth. I am happy that it's Juneteenth, but I have bittersweetness about this day. I first of all want to give honor to our pastor. Thank you so much for letting us into your house. And, of course, I bring greetings from my pastor, Reverend William Lamar. And I think of you often. We had a conversation at the airport years ago, and you told I need to go find me a church. And I did. I came by here a couple times that you were preaching from a PowerPoint. And I wasn't feeling that. So I went over to Pastor Lamar, who don't use a PowerPoint. But I love you anyway, and I'll be back every now and then. But thank you for bringing us here. Of course, Dr. D, thank you for all that you do. This brother is a long-distance runner, underestimates him. What I said about him recently on the occasion of his 80th birthday is I would ask for 80 more, but that would be greedy because he can't do 80 more. Nobody can. Even the good Lord didn't do any. He only did 33. But this brother is with us. He's in it to win it. I want to also just basically acknowledge all of our panelists. I am Dr. Julianne Malveau. I am an economist, author, dean of the College of Ethnic Studies at Cal State LA, inaugural dean of the College of Ethnic Studies at Cal State LA, which has Pan-African Studies, Chicano-Latino Studies, and Asian American Studies reporting to me. I also am starting a Department of American Indian Studies. Watch me grin, y'all. That was a little bit of a struggle, but we got it going on. I am an economist, as I said, and economics is about the study of who gets what, when, where, and how. Who gets what, when, where, and why. And what we know is that the foundation of this putrid nation, yes, I did say putrid nation, is enslavement. That there would be nothing here were there not enslavement. That there is utter denial about basically the contribution that enslavement has made to our country. Now, I ain't mad at white folks because most working class white folks weren't even in it. What I'm mad at is predatory capitalism, is a system that extracts surplus value from people. And so I love what Joy DeGroy said. She's a sister friend. She is brilliant. She is really talking about us coming together. But in order for us to come together, we must tell the truth. Understand that when Sheila Jackson Lee and her colleagues introduced legislation for Juneteenth, it passed by unanimous consent in the Senate, but about six of those devils had stuff to say on the side. Like, we all know this is the radical left. And 14 Republican congresspeople voted against Juneteenth. And one of the fools said, this is about critical race theory. No, it's not. Pastor, since I'm in your church, I will try to watch my adjectives. Therefore, it's just about the you-know-what truth. And those who know me well know what you-know-what might be. Could be anything. Well, but what I'm saying is, these folks, until we deal with the truth, we cannot heal. We must deal with the basic, utter truth. And here's the truth. What Joy said, what Joy DeGry said, what others have said, first of all, we was late. My grandmother, who was from Mississippi, would never celebrate Juneteenth because she said it was a celebration of black people being late. Now, she died in 1974. Hey, my grandmother was a trip. She also said that there was no moonwalk, that they were just in Las Vegas and walking through the desert. She was a trip. But anyway, Grandma Rosie Elizabeth Nelson, I called her out. But let me say that she wouldn't celebrate it, but we do celebrate it. But what Joy DeGroy said, which is important, is this. Enslavement did not end when they came from Galveston. Enslavement is still going on. There are some companies, Ron, I know you're about to cut me off, but let me just say this one thing. Okay, McDonald's, Wendy's, Walmart, Starbucks, Sprint, Verizon, Victoria's Secret, Fidelity, they are still using convict labor to get profits. I'm not going to repeat them. They go, let me repeat it again. But let's be clear. Enslavement is not over. Our people are still being enslaved. And the legacy of economic envy, which I know Brother Daniel is going to let me talk about a bit later, the legacy of economic envy is that whenever we get 1 cent, someone wants to take 2 cents back. We must be clear that we live, it's not new. We live in a culture of anti-blackness, a culture of attack on our people, and we have to stop it and our allies. And I want to give a shout out to our white and other brothers and sisters in the room. Thank you for being here. Bring your friends next time.
Dr. Julianne Malvo. So, Cam, even though you spoke, if you got a short one, I mean, you know, like a short one, you can drop it on us. You got a mic? That's your mic.
So, yes, my name is Cam Howard. I'm a three-time voted in National Male Co-Chair in COBRA. I've been in the reparations movement perhaps about 16, 17 years. Came in the movement when there was a mass exodus from the movement because of a lawsuit that we had filed in 2005. It was denied. The judge stated that we did not have status to bring a lawsuit, standing, and that kind of took the air out of the movement. The 9/11 attacks took the air out of the movement, but we struggled, continued to raise this issue. A repair, and I was fortunate enough to take part with NARC and Kichi and co-author the federal legislation that we're pushing now, H.R. 40. We revised it from a study bill to remedy bill, which the goal is to craft the proposals necessary to alleviate or repair all of those disparities that we exist, that we see among our communities and the dominant community in this country. And so I'm now the director of Reparations United, which is an organization that will look at particular injuries that communities across the country share and we'll look for proposals and ways that we can come together as in our own spaces and build out proposals and structures that begin to deliver that repair to our people. And so I'm excited. This is a very exciting time to be in the movement. Thank you all for coming, and hopefully what is shared from this panel will cause you to become more active. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. So now we want to have a conversation. I was mentored and tutored by one of the panelists to have this style of conversation, not other than Nkechi Taifa. She's the first one I ever heard say guided conversation, which is a good way of doing it, rather than everybody just speaking and having it on and so forth. Just have a conversation and pull it out. And I probably need to keep my mic live, because when I tap on it, that means you are talking too long. I don't want to have to step over there, because I will do that. I've been known to do that. Because we really want to leave time for you to step forward. And, you know, a limited number of people can get everybody to give your suggestions more than anything else. You may have questions, and we can answer those questions later. But we want to hear what you think. We want to hear your ideas. Some of you are active. Some of you are organizers. Want to get your opinions. So the first thing I want to do is get a quick reaction to the framing statements. You heard Dr. Joy DeGruy. You, of course, heard Sheila Jackson Lee. You heard Cam Howard. If you have thoughts about what they said, what it triggered in your mind in terms of substance, in terms of where we are and where we should be going from your perspective. Or you can just pivot and start talking about whatever you choose to talk about. But I wanted to begin with a kind of response from them. So we'll start with you, Dr. Lloyd.
Well, I definitely feel that the Cam's presentation really resonated with me on a lot of levels. I think that, you know, thinking about the atrocities that our people have suffered over the generations and how there needs to be an accounting for that, and we need to address that. Injuries were suffered, and we need to be able to come together and figure out what is the best way for us as a people to A, heal, but B, to B, somehow receive some sort of reparations for this generational hurt and pain and enslavement. It is so pervasive in almost every aspect of our lives, and it affects our people to the nth degree, that we need to do something. And I really appreciated exactly the way that you have put that.
Jan?
I really think hard on Dr. DeGruy's post-traumatic slave syndrome, but I also think about the flip side. Like, I really believe this country suffers from post-traumatic enslaver syndrome, where so many firmly believe we are owed nothing, we are due nothing, that what happened was just the past and we should let it go. Meanwhile, we are still enduring those crimes against humanity and the legacies of them. And so I still wonder how we can break through that false narrative, because with this post-traumatic enslaver syndrome, that's connected to all of these harms. People ask, is everything about race? And we know, yeah, it basically is in this country. But like, when you look at the history of tipping, when you look at why we're not increasing the federal minimum wage, why we have people that are working in prisons for these corporations, all of it is part of that post-traumatic enslaver syndrome, not wanting to let go, not wanting to fully acknowledge black people as full human beings with our own rights and agency. And in my mind, it's like this struggle between post-traumatic slave syndrome and post-traumatic, I guess, enslaver syndrome, and how we combat that to get our full repair.
All right. Okay. Sister Nkechi.
So thank you very much for those framing statements. And I think for both Joy DeGruy and Cam Howard, Joy DeGruy talked about the importance of his historical memory. And Cam talked about, Joy talked about basically you cannot repair which, unless you know what needs to be repaired. And I think Cam spoke about historical memory, and both of those themes resonated with me, particularly when I look at what I always quote from Mamie Till Mobley, the mother of Emmett Till, back in 1955, who demanded an open casket for the world to see what had been done to her son. And she demanded this open casket because she said that she did not want his memory swept under the rug. She wanted the world to see and to know. She wanted that historical, memory. She wanted folks to know just what the harm was, just what the injury was. And I say down to this day, we are still trying to open up these caskets so we can know the harm. Many of these things I'm just learning now. Many of them. You know, I knew about Tulsa back in 1985, actually, when the bomb was dropped on MOVE in Philadelphia, and someone said, well, that's not the first time a bomb was dropped. And regardless of whether you think it was actually a bomb on Tulsa, there was stuff being flown from the air and from airplanes, if you put it that way. But many folk are just learning about Tulsa over the past year or so. Okay, many of us, I didn't know anything about Elaine, Arkansas until National African American Reparations Commission went into Elaine, Arkansas and exposed all of that. I only knew about Rosewood because John Singleton did a movie, a Hollywood movie on Rosewood, and it really opened up my eyes. And then when I heard about Wilmington, North Carolina, that again was a result of a documentary. So we need to begin to really wholesale open up these caskets so like the little people, like the little girls right there, the little twins right there will know our history. This is not the time to take black history out of the schools. This is the time to inundate our schools and all like that with our history. Thank you.
All right. Give it up. All right. Caskets. Dr. Julianne Malvo.
Okay, folks. I appreciate everybody's passion, and I certainly appreciate the framing statements. Cam, that was so very comprehensive and important to put it in the context of the history. And that's what we're losing now. What we're getting is a resistance to history. And when Sheila called out the name, and I can call her Sheila, she's my friend. She is Congresswoman, but I can also call her Sheila. We've broken bread together. When she called out the name of the sister who detailed her oppression, what happened to her? A chill has to go through your body. And I don't care whether you're black or white or Latino, Asian, a chill has to go through your body when you think of a woman being brutalized so. But in order to brutalize, you must first dehumanize. And that's literally what has happened. If you look back at the history, initially black people were brought here enslaved. White were brought here as indentured servants. No distinction was made between them until a point in time when it became clear that we could be exploited by the color of our skin. Before that, we were you could even go into Virginia and find records of interracial marriage. You could go into Virginia and into North Carolina and find relations between people who are not the wealthy being relatively equivalent, not completely, but relatively. But then when you fast forward it to where they began to codify inferiority with a narrative, as Jam says, a narrative about our inferiority, that gave them permission to basically dehumanize and then from dehumanize, exploit. Therefore, David Walker's appeal is one of the most important pieces of historical literature that you will ever read because he talked about appealing to white people, appealing for our humanity. In 1832, in North Carolina, a law was passed that said to teach a slave to read is to excite dissatisfaction to the detriment of the general population. Now, I used that when I became president of Bennett College as my opening statement to talk about why education of black people, and especially black women, because when black women learn, our children learn, and why that was so very important. But let's connect a couple of dots. So to teach a slave to read is to excite dissatisfaction, but some people say you want to hide something from a black person, put it in a book. Now, is there some inconsistency up in here? Meanwhile, those who taught enslaved people to read, black people were flogged up to 50 times for teaching someone to read. White people were fined up to then $200, which today would be like 10 grand, for teaching someone to read. So meanwhile, you want to hide to a black person, put in a book. Nah, you were afraid of me being up in a book. You are frightened of what I will learn when I've been up in a book. And this is what we need to deal with when we're dealing with this. So Oklahoma, the site of Tulsa, was one of the first states to pass a law forbidding so-called critical race theory. Now, he ain't going to give me enough time to break that all down and tell you they don't teach it K through 12. They don't even teach it in higher ed often. We have it in an upper division class at Cal State LA. You can't come in as a fresh person and say, I won't take a class on critical race theory, because we don't have it. You might get introduction to Pan-African studies, something like that, but you're not going to get that. So these people have created a narrative that allows them to replace reality. And this is reality. Predatory capitalism is oppressive. It allows people to extract surplus value from others. Listen to me, y'all, when I tell you this is not just about black people. We're the basis of it. But white women, y'all didn't have nothing either. I'm in church, so I didn't say what I was going to say. I said nothing. Pastor, you're a powerful influence here. You know, other poor white men, y'all couldn't, if you didn't have property, you couldn't vote either. So let's just call, this is about the maintenance of economic hegemony against the rest of us. And those poor white people, I don't understand poor white folks who vote against their economic interests in order to vote for their racial interests. You cannot eat white. You cannot put peanut butter on white. White bread made it, not white. So how you voting for that orange orangutan who essentially is not going to have his grandbabies play with your grandbabies? How do you do that? You do that because you get some pecuniary value from whiteness.
Right.
We have to unpack that.
We're going to unpack that a little bit more in a minute, Ashley. I want to flesh that theme out. That's okay. That's all right. Cam, your thoughts about, I don't know, you can't reflect on yourself necessarily, but you may want to reflect on Dr. McGrew or whatever you heard at this point.
Yeah, so as you stated, healing, you can't have healing without justice. And that really resonated with me, because what we are, and I go back to the language.
Can I say a bit about that, to tease that out a bit? And I say that because there is a way in which I think white America, but sometimes even black folks, there's a sense that, you know, reconciliation comes first. And so when the tragedy occurred in Charleston, South Carolina, you know, people would say, oh, look how they forgive so easily. And it's the sense that somehow or another that reconciliation is the order of the day. And dare I say that some of that comes out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, and it became popularized in this country. And so it's almost as like, it's like reconciliation. And it calls on our people to suffer, and then there are people who look at us and they marvel at our suffering. So I just wanted to just amplify that a little bit, because I think it's an important point to tease out.
Sure. So reconciliation actually benefits the perpetrator of the crime. It's more than it benefits the person whose the crime has been committed against. It gives them a feeling of wholeness or humanity. So it really doesn't affect the, in fact, it can re-traumatize mm-hmm. those who have been affected by whatever injury or whatever crime has been committed. But white America wants us to just get past what has happened to us, as if time itself is going to heal. And we see that the injuries have accumulated more and more over time, as opposed to healing over time. And so, and that goes back to what you say, you can't have healing without justice. It has to be inserted within the communities of harm, specifically targeted resources to address those injuries so that healing can take place. So you want healing to take place, but there's no resources targeted toward the illness. It can't happen. There has to be justice before there's healing. And so in one particular area that we know to be, we're understanding now, the area of transgenerational inheritance, transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, where the environment affects the epigenome of the gene, and the environment that's traumatic will affect it over several generations, 3, 4, 5, 6 generations. We know in mice, it could be up to 6 generations. That's the transgenerational component. So we cannot just leave things to themselves and think it's going to be healed. It's not going to happen. And now we have the science to show this. That really resonated. You cannot have healing in this country. You cannot have equality, equity, anything like that in this country unless targeted resources are directed for those particular injuries, and those targeted resources is reparations.
All right. Okay. That's right. Y'all can say amen. Y'all can clap. That's right. So now I want to take on this question because you do hear a lot of times, we're on radio shows, whatever, you hear white people, rich, not so rich, poor, whatever, they'll say, well, I had nothing to do with this. Why should I be involved? Why should my tax dollars be involved? And it'd be some of them poor white folks too, Dr. Malvo. I contend that even they, that all white people in this country benefited from enslavement, all of them. But I want our panelists to talk about that so that our audience, to the degree that they may not, will have the ammunition when they're confronted with that to be able to challenge that, to talk about why it is that in one way or another, and it's really not in some ways, it's not even personal, but that all white people benefited from the enslavement of our ancestors. I don't know who wants to start. No, in case you wanted to jump first. I'm going to let Nkechi jump first. No, you go first. Yeah.
Okay, so as I said in my TED Talk, we all stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. Although the present generation of whites may be innocent of what their forefathers and their foremothers did, as a race, they stand in a privileged position as a result of the actions of their predecessors. Each generation passes its debts as well as its assets along to the next generation. The heritage which whites in this country enjoy is what has been called white skin privilege, benefiting from a society, a state, a structural, social structure which is governed by white supremacy. And although we may debate the who, what, when, why, and how, I'll just use your term, of measurement, there is no question that whites in this country, no matter how rich or poor they are, no matter when they came, benefit from the fruits of over 400 years of unjust enrichment.
You know, all people in this society, all non-black people, benefit from the structure of predatory capitalism. If you look at that structure, it's not personal at all. So someone who comes and says, well, I never had any slaves, not in the 21st century, you didn't. But if you were in a mine, working in the mine next to a black person who was making half your wage, somehow there was something that you privileged that you inherited. I prefer Nkechi, and I think we should begin to unpack how we use language. I was in Buffalo, and I mean, I don't cry much. And someone told me I was like a toasted marshmallow. Hard on the outside, a little soft on the inside, but hard as you know what on the outside. Pastor, I ain't going there. But in any case, I cried at what happened when our people talked about how this white boy went and found the zip code where he could find the most black people at the grocery store. And one of the most humane things you can do, go get you some GD groceries. Okay, I almost slipped. Just go get you some eggs and some bacon and some, you know, whatever. But the fact is that that is a structure that has allowed this kind of resentment and economic envy. And we can't look, we're not mad at the people until they start picking up guns and coming to our Mother Emanuel Church, AME, in South Carolina. We're mad at a structure that has systematically oppressed. And what we have to deal with is a structure. And here's what we know. We know white folks who know better, but they are benefiting. We look at this Congress, look at the Senate, and look at who's making money. Joe Manchin is a multimillionaire, not because he's exploiting black people, but because he's exploiting white people. They're not that many of us anymore that are coal miners, but this boy has made millions doing mine work. So wouldn't you talk about, well, I didn't have any slaves, though, but you have a structure that allowed you to exploit. It allowed you to become a landlord while I'm a renter. It allowed you to become a supervisor while I'm a line worker. It allowed you to exert your picayune privilege in ways that exploit. It allowed you to rape my mama, my grandmama, and anybody else. See, you don't get black people who look like me unless white people was crazy. You know, unless they chose to exploit us. And so let's really be clear, when people want to make it personal, it is not personal, it is structural, and you benefited from the structure, and whether you made $1, $5, and $1 billion, there was a structure that allowed you to benefit where we did not. And fast forward, now you're going to have some white folks tell you, well, yeah, but you got Oprah. You got magic. We got black people who are multimillionaires, billionaires, all that. So what y'all complaining about? Well, if you took all Oprah's money and divided by all the black people, each got $3. So it's irrelevant. Yes, there will be exceptionalism, and it's called capitalistic exceptionalism that allows a few to climb up to the top so then they can throw that back at you and say, well, yeah, you got black millionaires. Nothing about a black millionaire has changed the terms and conditions of our economic life.
Okay. Anyone else want to address that? Anyone else? Well, I do. I'm going to add a little something to the mix. Because I think that we need to clarify it even more. And I and all of you know this. There is a white woman. Her name is Trina Brown. And she wrote a book and a documentary called Traces of a Trade. So let's go to enslavement. You did not have to enslave people to benefit from enslavement. So, for example, if you have out of New England, one of the regions of the country that benefited most from enslavement was not the South. It was up South in New England. Why? Because there was slave trafficking going through something called the triangular trade. And in that triangular trade, it was so robust that what it did was it created an industry in shipbuilding, in textiles. So the point is, even if you were not directly involved in slavery, you got a job in the textile industry. You got a job in the shipbuilding industry, if you understand what I'm saying. So you didn't have to be directly involved. You benefited from it. In fact, the classic book on this is Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. Barclays Bank, Lloyd's of London, all of them. So you got all those employees. They weren't involved in the slave trade directly. They were the beneficiaries of it. And so that's why you have to counter people. It's not about you individually. I was in Youngstown, Ohio in 1956. The Hungarian Revolt broke out because it's also about the legacies of enslavement, the exclusionary policies. And when you worked in the steel mills, there was a cap. You could not rise above a certain level. And you had the so-called black, the labor gang, the black jobs, and so forth and so on. In Youngstown, Ohio, there are neighborhoods that are heavy, we call them Slovaks, Hungarians, so forth and so on. People came and they went into those neighborhoods. They went into the steel mills where my father worked. He couldn't go above grade, let's say, 4. There's 5, 6, 7, and 8. When they went in, these folks were immediately employed in 5, 6, 7, and 8. Now, later on, you'll hear them saying, but I had nothing to do with discrimination. Well, you may not have anything to do with discrimination, but you took advantage of the white skin privilege, and you passed that on intergenerationally. And what was a benefit from you was a deficit for our community. It was a deficit for our community. So we want you to be able to have that information so when people who are well-meaning make that argument, you can contend with it because all white people. Now, here's where the class element comes in, as Dr. Malvo pointed out. You know, the big white folks got more. They benefited disproportionately, more than the poor white folks did. And you can also go into things like the Homestead Act, for example. You know, a lot of land went out. We didn't get the land. White folks got the land. They said, well, we ain't got nothing to do. Yeah, but you got land we couldn't get, and you could pass that on what? Intergenerationally. So we have to be very clear about those concepts. All right. Is it quick?
Back. Real quick. Let's talk about the Federal Housing Act. Let's talk about the ways that our communities were redlined. Let's talk about the GI Bill. Let's talk about the fact that only 600 black men in Mississippi were able to go to college on the GI Bill. When they had to go appeal to a draft board. And when they appealed, brother man would say, I want to go to college. He said, nah, man, you can go to barber school. Okay, so the GI Bill, which transformed working class white people into middle class white people, did not include us. So there is a history of legislation, that was deliberately exclusionary. And we need to be clear. Your example about your dad and the steel mill is perfect because none of these things were written down. I mean, it was custom. Black man comes, you're level one. White man comes, you're level five. Black man works at 20 years, you get up to level four. You never get to level five. So all of this stuff was about white skin privilege, and I, you know, like I said, I want to unpack, not today, he ain't gonna let me, but we want to unpack the terminology of white supremacy. A brother at Buffalo, actually, our bus driver at Buffalo said, y'all need to stop saying that. Stop saying white supremacy because you're allowing them to believe they're supreme. I said, so what you call it? He said, call it white insanity. I'm like, all right, we're going to find something better to say, but let's just deal with the fact that we know that all these unwritten rules created the wealth gap that we live in today.
Right. Now, by the way, we don't have to go that far because we know we had a beloved ancestor who told us that all the time, and that's Nat. That's right.
Yes,
Nana,
yes she did.
That's right.
Yes,
Nana Patricia Newtland. When we call out her name, because she used to say that all the time. Y'all stop giving it up. Y'all stop it. And in fact, the Association of Black Psychologists, the Community Healing Network, I'm pretty sure y'all say the same thing. Stop giving that up. Now I'm going to turn to another subject that was referenced earlier. Cam Howard said something about the NARC, National African American Reparations Commission, saying that all black people harmed in America by America should be repaired by America in America. And he said that because there is a kind of little controversy brewing, because some people are saying that a reparation should be restricted to only those persons who come from the era of enslavement or who can trace their lineage to same. And I think that there are some of us who say that that's not the case. And it's not that we're mad at anybody. It's just that we want to talk about, you know, many of the things that you've already been talking about. So I want to just open this conversation up for each of you to give your take on this whole question of who should get reparations. Should it be restricted, or how are we seeing that?
Okay, I'd like to talk about it.
Jam, wants to get right up in that right quick. All right, yes.
I'm always the bad person when it comes to this topic, according to some. I think a lot of times when we talk about who deserves reparations, it goes back to this initial harm of the erasure, erasure of identity, erasure of the histories behind what happened. So a lot of times when we have this conversation, people talk about the importance of lineage, but I think really folks that push that are confusing that with nationality, and that's two different things. If we are to talk about the lineage of people that were enslaved in the United States, Africans that were enslaved in the United States, we come from at least 30 different African ethnicities, which automatically would have made the transatlantic slave trade and chattel slavery in America multi-ethnic. Then on top of that, we had the intra-American slave trade, where our ancestors were basically cycled through what is now the United States and different parts of the Caribbean and so forth. So then it becomes multinational. So on top of the descendants of Africans that were enslaved in the United States, like myself, a descendant of Africans enslaved in Georgia and South Carolina, there are people that are of Haitian descent that may have not been a part of chattel slavery directly in the United States, but were here early on in the 1800s. The author of Lift Every Voice and Sing, grandmother, is from Haiti. She came here during the Haitian Revolution. So, but people don't really realize all the interconnectedness. I believe his mother was also raised in Barbados or somewhere in the Caribbean. And so then we have folks coming into we have a whole bunch of different Caribbean influences in Louisiana. basically in South Carolina, the Bajans are Gullah Geechee, and the Gullah Geechee are Bajans. We got African Americans communities that are in Trinidad. We are actually a multinational people, but people don't know that because that history is hidden. It is not taught that we were not restricted. Well, they tried to restrict us to these borders in different parts of our history, but it isn't taught that we are more than these borders. Our lineage mm-hmm. is more than these borders. Our ancestors are still on the continent of Africa, and they're here in the United States, and they're in Barbados, and in Trinidad, and in Haiti. It was 15,000 African Americans that went to Haiti when they had the chance. So it's so much interconnectedness there, but I think it must be emphasized that the harms that were done to us weren't done to us because we were American descendants of slaves, because we weren't Americans. Thank we didn't you. Become American until the 14th Amendment.
Some
we were
people
not
feel that we still
we were not that. Americans and men, like you said, like Nikita, you said, we might not still be Americans according to different feelings, because we still don't get the full benefits of not only citizenship but humanity in this country. But we weren't American descendants of slaves. We were none of those things. We were Africans. And then the harms continued to any person of African descent that touched this land. They were denied housing. They were denied fair mm-hmm. wages. They were denied health care. They were left to die. They went through all of these different things over time. And so that's when we say, things like what Ken was saying, all Africans that were harmed by America must be repaired by America. That's what we're saying. It's not because we want to harm our justice claim. It's just that we know our justice claim is much wider than this.
Yes.
It's just that we know we need to close the door fully on white, Dr. Malvo would say we shouldn't say white supremacy.
White insanity.
But we need to close the door fully on these crimes against humanity, and we cannot do that if we're trying to parse and splice and deny certain parts of our legacies and lineages due to whatever competitions, internal competitions, or xenophobia. So it's a whole lot of different components to it, but I urge people to understand that the lineage of African Americans is much larger
yes.
than these borders, and what happened to us is much larger than what is often emphasized.
You
all
know,
right.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting. This nonsense is a distraction. When people talk about who should get the reparations, first, we want to pass H.R. 40 and acknowledge what is owed. That's all you have to do, y'all. We're not sitting here parsing pennies here and nickels there. The NARC 10-point program, which is on IBW21.org, the NARC 10-point program lays out not just monetary reparations, but also the repair that has to happen. It's not just about the Benjamins. It's also about the psychological. It's about the health. You've talked about the multi-generational impact. So when you get these people, and I'm not even going to call them out because, like I said, I don't curse in the church. But in any case, these people who are coming up with this nonsense about can you prove your lineage? Now, I must say, Reverend Amos Brown, who's on the California Commission, is a dear friend. He's known me since I was a kid, which means he's older than dirt because I'm as old as dirt. But Reverend Brown is like, you know, if you start bringing all these other people in, it dilutes the claim. I think quite the opposite.
That's right.
I think that what Jim has said is absolutely true. We did the triangular slave trade, you know, the ways that we were all interconnected, that enslaved people who were here would sit back to parts of the Caribbean when they needed workers to harvest sugar, that people in the Caribbean were sent here. And they just sort of traded us like we were bushels of sugar, not human beings. When I look at my own lineage, I mean, we can trace back to Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, but also my maternal grandfather was Haitian. He came here when there were some challenges in Haiti and met my grandmother and hung around for a while. Not a long time, a little while. But in any case, so, and we can all trace that Caribbean in us, that African in us, all of that in us. This is nonsense, but what it is, let's be clear, it's a distraction.
Right.
It allows people who do not mean us well to go down into the weeds and say, well, who should get the reparations? How much should they be? Well, I mean, let's look at what happened with Japanese Americans. I mean, 20 grand was not a perfect sum, but it was a sum and it was an acknowledgement. I don't know what we're going to end up with,
right,
but I know that the first step is H.R. 40.
Right.
Let's stay with that.
Right. All right, let me we're gonna get that's right, give it up. We're gonna get to the audience in a minute, then, but I also just want to, like, you know, put it another way too, right? Because Malcolm X once said, he said, we're allowed to say hell. He said, we all catch hell for the same reason. We all catch hell because we're black people. They did not ask Abner Louima, I was at the Center for Constitutional Rights at that time, when he was tortured. They didn't say, are you from Haiti?
Hello.
Amadou at Diallo, when he was gunned down, they didn't say, are you from Guinea? They didn't ask that question. We all catch hell for the same reason. And if we're talking about we're going to strict people on the basis of lineage, you mean Shirley Chisholm ain't eligible? Harry Banner, day old man ain't eligible? Kwame Ture as a Stokely Carmichael ain't eligible? No, we ain't leaving nothing on the table. We want it all. It's all. We do all our reparations. We ain't leaving nothing on the table. Now, here's what I want to do. Cam Howard, I want you to give us a compelling reason why H.R. 40 needs to be passed now. And we'll be and the next thing we're going to do is we're going to go out there and we're going to hear from our audience. So, H.R. 40, why do we need to get it done right now? Why can't we no longer wait?
So, I think everybody here has asked that question. You know, the injury is so substantial in our communities. You know, the gaps are widening. The quality of life is worsening for black people. Black people who are even in the middle class and of an upper income level live substandardly when compared to others of their same class or income level. We look at the tremendous amount of violence that is happening in black communities right now all over the country. There's record levels of violence in Chicago and New Orleans and New York and St. Louis and, you know, every major city where black people are at. That violence stems from governmental policy at the executive level for multiple generations that excluded blacks in general and black men in particular from the labor force. And now you have generations of children, boys and girls, who didn't have the family structure necessary for taking advantage of the school system, taking advantage of you know, all the things in the community that nurtures a child. Well, they didn't have those. And so now you're seeing the results of that. It looks like murdering, you know, brothers and sisters, murdering children, carjacking children. All of these things as a result, again, of the public policy of this government waged against our community and all the community has suffered what we suffered at the hands of this government. The disparities across health, across education, across economics, across the criminal justice system, all of these things demand that this bill be passed right now at this particular moment. We can't wait, what, another generation? When we have the ability and the resources to address this situation right now in this country, why wait? H.R. 40 now.
Amen.
H.R. 40 now. Let's hear it. H.R. 40 now.
H.R. 40 now.
All right. Okay, so we're going to hear from our audience, and the way we're going to do this is we're going to take, like, maybe five hands. I see one here, two here, three, I see four, five. So in that order, come to the microphone here and talk to us. I hold the mic.
Okay. Greetings, everyone.
Greetings.
Greetings. It's been amazing to be here with you. I listened to Dr. Malvo and Sister Taifa on WPFW. I don't know how either one of them forgot to mention that, because I think that's kind of important. And greetings to everyone. Just three quick points. Two of them kind of relate to the language of repair and the collective consciousness. Youth engagement I'm not sure what's going on. I'm hoping that you all have some type of youth engagement around this. We have some young brothers over here that have been very patient. I think one has not at all. And these two little sisters have been doing a wonderful job sitting here right in the front. But I'm just wondering what type of youth engagement you have going on. In terms of language of repair, I think that we have to work on shifting the language and taking a new approach to language. One of the things that constantly comes up is the idea of the right. And a lot of times, even though I know it refers to a political position, it's a double meaning in that. And it always implies that someone is correct. And we always seem to hear that a whole lot. And the left kind of like goes to the left. Collective consciousness. I think that there's work in between the both. We galvanize around voting. However, Dr. Malveaux brought up a lot of companies that we should really be reflecting on and how we engage with those companies. But one of the things that a lot of us are really strung out on is caffeine. And some of those companies are not fair trade. Some of the companies that sell chocolate, some of the companies that sell coffee, and we run to them. And, you know, some of it is because it's in our bloodstream. We think that our nervous system needs these things, but we don't realize the harm that these things are causing globally, and this has already become a very global conversation.
Okay.
Thank
you very much. We have to make it a little shorter. Come on. No. I got it here. They want me to use this mic?
Where do they want us to look?
This way? Yeah, but I want to. We got it together. But I also want to be able to talk to them. So anyway, what we're talking about is recommendations, by the way. So I'm going to give everybody, you got like a minute and a half.
Okay.
I got it.
Okay, so my question is that what's the importance of literary work in this struggle? Because we talk about like Marcus Garvey, we talk about Bob Marley, we talk about Langston Hughes and other persons who, like in the 1920s, who use literary work to help in this struggle. I've been looking on, people don't know, like Sarah Barton, Mary Turner, and we don't uncover these people, and as somebody say, we don't open these coffins. So I believe that literary work can help to bring awareness and help to fulfill the struggle. I'm doing some type of literary work right now to help in that.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's give it up. All right. The importance of art and culture. Hakim Adabudi, one of his most powerful poems is about art. He talks about that. Come right home. Yes, sir.
Thank you for all your work, first of all. I know 25 years ago, it's hard to imagine it being at the point it is now, so thank you for your work. I wanted to ask, there are several local initiatives, Evanston, I think it's Indiana or Illinois, a couple in South Carolina. There's one right here in Greenbelt, Maryland. Of reparation initiatives, what do you see as should be a model for a local one, you know, with the understanding that the resources are different than on a national level?
Right. All right, very good. The question of art, question of art, and local initiatives. So somebody get ready. We are going to give people a chance to respond to those questions. Yes, ma'am.
Hello, panel. Greetings, panel. Thank you all for coming. And he kind of picked my question. I was going to ask that as well. I'm actually here. I was here with Mayor candidate James Butler. He just came in to listen in, but he had to leave early. But he's actually one of the candidates who's running, who's promoting reparations right on his campaign. So along with the last question, how do you see us working at the local level? How do you see the reparations bill working at the local level? When our candidate goes around talking about reparations to the city on citywide, people tell him that this is something that can't be done. The local administration tells him it's something that's far-fetched that cannot be done. So how do you see that?
All right, come right ahead.
You're from CBTU, so a couple years ago. Two quick questions. The Native American slave trade, is that going to be addressed? Because some tribes actually trafficked our people. The last slaves that were emancipated from the Native American slave trade didn't happen until 1866. So that's actually the real Juneteenth. The second part is black slave ownership. That did happen. I just want you guys to be very careful of that, because that's a narrative that your opposition may try to use against you. I collect black history documents. I'm based locally, and I do have documents from actual black slave owners, so you're more than welcome to study them and craft your narrative. So I'm available for help. I have business cards, too.
All right, thank you very much. Let's take the last one here. The five civilized tribes he's referring to, the Dawes Rolls and all that stuff, and we want to unpack that. So, yes, sir.
So thank you for coming. I'm a member here at Shiloh Baptist Church, and we definitely love to hear you speak, and this is a great, has been a great topic. One thing I've heard about the different arguments for reparations and the reasons for it and how it affects with all of us, but what I haven't heard, though, is that what does reparations look like? Right. I firmly believe that if we're marching somewhere, we're going somewhere, you have to paint a picture of the goal. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like for us?
All right. Okay. Well, we're going to get answers to those questions. And let's see. Let's start with the last one, because Dr. Malvo actually addressed it with the 10-point program. So you want to take on the question of what does reparations look like?
Sure. First of all, thank you all of you for your questions and comments. We really do appreciate the engagement with the audience. All of us here are, except for this brother, but maybe he is, a member of the NARC, the National African American Reparations Commission, and we've been working together since 2015 under the leadership of Dr. Daniels to figure out what reparations might look like. That's why we have a 10-point plan. That's why we refer you to IBW21.org. To look at it, to look at the things we're talking about, reclaiming sacred sites, places where people were lynched. Now, we have to acknowledge that. See, because what Jim has said about erasure is so very important. People don't want to know, and the brother who mentioned Mary Turner, thank you. Mary Turner was a sister. They lynched her. Nkechi, you and I would have been in the next two trees. They lynched her for being mouthy.
Yeah.
And belligerent. They said, okay, we're going to get them too. But she basically went to the courthouse to demand an explanation for why her husband was lynched. Mm-hmm. After 14 people were lynched in 14 days in Valdosta, Georgia, because a white boy tried to extract their labor and wanted them to work for free. And when they start bucking up, start lynching them. And she went and said, you're going to explain this to me. She was 19. She was pregnant. She was 9 months pregnant. They hung her by her ankles.
Cut that fetus out.
Cut the fetus out and stomped it. And stomped it.
Right.
So I just appreciate the brother mentioned that, because we talk about lynchings. Most of the lynchings were of black men, but black women were also lynched. What does reparations look like? That's why H.R. 40 is a study commission that's allowing us to study what could be possible.
Right.
Cash payments can be possible, but if it's only cash, believe me, y'all, we need more than that.
Right.
We need education. We need our HBCUs to be fully funded. We need to make sure that we are made whole in every way, that we are full citizens, and that's going to require dollars. Right. And should white folks who didn't have slaves contribute? Yeah, because anytime anything else happens, you get some of it. Whatever they say, there's going to be a tax break, you get some of it. So now there's going to be a tax penalty, you're going to get some of that too.
Right. Let me quickly say that if you go to the 10-point program, we talk about two types of benefits. One is direct benefits, which could be cash and other kind of things. But we also talk about collective benefits or
yes.
community benefits. For example, economic development. Developing healthcare infrastructure, because we know that. Communications infrastructure in our community. Did I say health already? And education infrastructure. These are big picture ideas. And one of the things that we talk about is land. For example, we still need to work with our Native American brothers and sisters to get full repair to the degree that that's possible. However, they have land over which they have semi-sovereignty. They can build casinos, they can build schools and so forth. Well, the U.S. government has millions and millions and millions of dollars, millions of acres of land. We want some land like that so we can build our Wakanda village, if you will. You see what I'm saying? So we are thinking big in terms of what reparations can look like.
And Dr. Daniels, may I just say that I always said that the harms from the enslavement era and beyond were multifaceted. Thus, the remedies must be multifaceted as well. And all the things that you're talking about, and also one of the harms from the enslavement era was the denial of the right to self-determination.
That's right, absolutely.
There's some people who want to go back to Africa. Right. They should not have to swim in the ocean naked. They should have the resources necessary to make that repatriation a reality. And then all the other things we're talking about, folk want to be full citizens of this country. There must be changes in policies and practices that go beyond basic public policy that seeks to make that citizenship real. For those who want other things, that there's so many choices that are there that we would never allow.
And by the way, I don't know which is either the first or second point in the 10-point program speaks exactly to that.
Yes.
And that is that full repatriation knowledge program and full repatriation, so that when you, if, and then there are people in, on the African continent who they're beginning to deal with this question and wanting us to come back and so forth, but you shouldn't have to go back empty-handed. You should go back with some benefits in hand. CAM, local reparations, Evanston, Illinois, you were very much involved in it, as was Nkechi Taifa. Let's talk a bit about what local reparations can look like, what it does look like, and what a potential model looks like.
So in the area of local reparations, it's not new in a sense, because prior in the, probably 20 years ago, we were looking at local reparations in regards to slavery disclosure ordinances, cities getting laws passed on that would require corporations and insurance companies and things like that to disclose whether or not they had any culpability in the atrocities of our people. But in 2019, there was a huge leap from that, and that was when the city of Evanston passed a legislation that required the city to fund $10 million toward reparative initiatives. It was the first municipal-wide reparations program in the country. The National African American Commission went there, and we subsequently subsidized the work that Evanston has done, certified, I should say, the work that Evanston has done. Given the stamp that it is a model that can be replicated. It can be replicated because, one, looks at what we call the main criteria of reparations, is that the injured party has to be the party who says what the actual injury is. The city cannot state what it is. The injured party have to be the one who determine what the remedy is. The city can't do that. In the end, it can't be regular public policy. And so we see that that's happening, that particular model is being replicated around the country. The sister who started that particular initiative, she was an alderman at the time, Robin Ruth Simmons. She subsequently started an organization called First Repair that brings people like my sister, like candidates, you know, who want to come to forums to learn how to craft legislation. What are the strategies necessary? What are the bodies necessary to craft local reparations? You can go to firstrepair.org and you can be assisted with that, or the National African American Reparations Commission, NARC.org, and you also can be assisted in that fashion. But local reparations allows, what I say is four purposes. One, it pushes the federal legislation. We know that historically, what has happened on a local level, when it's amplified and replicated, it pushes the federal government to act. We know that by the Brown versus the Board of Education, that desegregated school, that was a small city of Topeka, Kansas. That decision went all the way to the Supreme Court that then initially, subsequently, desegregated the schools across the country. So local reparations, the more of those that happen, the more they're challenged, the more work we do around them can also lead to, and has been shown to assist us in the federal legislation. Local reparations act as triage. There are certain issues that are really important in major injury areas within these cities that you can apply some really targeted resources toward those areas before the federal resources come down the line. You can do that on the local level. You can't do everything on the local level, but you can look at those areas that are most important to that community. The city of Evanston said it was the loss of housing of their black residents. So they focused a targeted program on addressing this housing for that particular, for the blacks in that community. And that can be done all around the country. The third thing it does, it allows us to prepare policies and programs that can be scaled up once national resources come down. We have examples of this program, this housing program, this public safety program, this educational program, this program that's dealing around, you know, guaranteed basic income or whatever. They're happening all around the country in these cities. Now the government, when we do HR 40, the commission will look at all of those and say, well, yeah, we can scale this one up. This has to be tweaked. We can put a few billion dollars in here, you know. So it allows us to have shovel-ready programs the minute the commission is finished with this work, or the minute the commission is assembled. And finally, it allows us to pull structures together that can deliver the repair once those federal resources come down the line. So local reparations is very, very important. It is the area that the most energy in the movement is being targeted at this particular moment. So if you don't have, everybody here is in D.C. primarily or in the area, but as my sister said, in Greenbelt, right outside of Baltimore, is it?
D.C.
Right outside of D.C. Mm-hmm. Wherever you're at, there should be some type of push around local reparations, some targeted resources at the areas that are most needed to be addressed in your black community in that particular city, because that's what really reparations are, targeted resources to address injuries resulting from crimes committed against us.
Sister Nkechi Taifa.
Okay, so I just
I have a different question. Because you have all these different talents and so forth, but you've been in that creative space. Because one of the questions was art and culture and whatever. You've done children's books. You've written plays and done. So would you speak to the importance of art and culture? And Jam, I don't know if you want to join in that conversation too.
Definitely.
So quickly, would y'all, and then I'm going to give each of you like a closing charge around, but I did not want to overlook that question on art because it is so important to our fabric and to our being. So, Jam, you go first.
Okay.
Okay, so that's one of the main things that we utilize at the National Black Cultural Information Trust, our stories, our literature, because stories serve a dual purpose. They are to maintain our culture and our identity and heritage, but also to share information. And our ancestors used to have to do that when they steal away in the middle of the night and do their own church services and story times and such. But literature plays a very key role in sharing information, the information that I was talking about earlier about the expansiveness of African-American lineage is something that will be found in literature. So we share a lot of literature and different articles and things like that on our website. And for the youth, we focus on cultural storytelling. So like I said earlier, yesterday we gave out hundreds of Juneteenth coloring books that tell the story of emancipation and so forth, and we give out all these different cultural children's books, and we're hosting a story time series soon with NBCI Trust. But so those are some of the key things, because when you talk about reparations, a lot of it has to be focused on education as to why and how and what happened, and our literature tells that story in so many different robust ways.
Narrative is important, yes.
Yeah, thank you for that, Jam. And along with that question, someone asked about the youth and students and all. And I was a youth when I started in this movement. When I started reparations movement, I was around 16 years old, and like around when I was 18, 19 or whatever, was when I wrote my children's book. which talked about famous black heroes and heroines, things that you don't hear, we did not hear about at that time, which was in the, when was that, I don't know, mid-70s or whatever. And then when I found out that those books were banned last year, even though they've been out of print in decades, I put them back in print because it's so very important. But in terms of arts and culture, it is so very critical that the artists, that the musicians, the songwriters, that's how the Martin Luther King holiday came into existence.
Yes.
Because Stevie Wonder creatively did that song, Happy Birthday. And now we have at least two or three or whatever groups, one of which you were playing here, doing reparation songs because we need to infatuate the, I'm talking too loud, the minds, the creative minds of people, and we do that through the culture. Okay, so reparations is not just the black-white wealth gap, it's not just the mathematical principles, et cetera, but it's also the infusion of the culture into what we are doing, and that is what captures the imagination.
Okay,
you know,
hold it. Starting with you, Dr. John. One minute each, closing charge statement, so we can wrap this up. Your closing statement, sir.
Well, I think everybody has heard a lot today. My hope is that you're feeling energized, that you feel uplifted.
How y'all feeling?
How y'all feeling?
All right, go ahead.
And it's the information that you've learned today that either validated something or something new. You take that and get involved at the local level. Go back to your community, educate others, right? Inspire others to get involved. And that's the biggest thing that we can do, not only just individually, but as a collective, is make a difference. So don't just leave this energy here today. Take it, inspire others, go out, vote, get involved, support organizations like the ones that are up here on this stage. Thank you.
Jan.
I would really emphasize the importance of, as we lead this space, Sankofa, looking back to go forward, continue to dig back into that information, learn more and more about what happened, learn more and more about our ancestors, not just as enslaved people, but as people, their identities, their cultures, their languages, their truths, their stories. And bring those forward, bring those more and more to light. There's a story right now about Sojourner Truth that was recently uncovered by, I believe, the New York Public Library about her going to court to get her son freed. And that is something that so many people didn't know and is becoming more and more uncovered, and she actually won. But these are things that are a part of our past that can help energize us for the future. Reparations is not a new call. It's a very old call that we need to continue to push forward, and we use our history and our cultures and our heritages to move forward with that.
Reparations now, yes.
So thank you. I would like to stress again the importance of the passage now of H.R. 40, either via legislation or via executive order. This is the first time, and I cannot imagine when we have control of the House, we have control of the Senate, we have control of the executive branch. This is a historic moment that we find ourselves in right now. We must not squander this moment. We might not see the stars aligned while they are in this fashion for a very, very long time. That is why we're calling upon President Biden to enact H.R. 40 into existence via executive order so that the commission can get up to be established and start its work and finish before the end of this administration.
All right. Thank you very much. Dr. Malvo, your closing statement.
Well, first of all, reparations now. H.R. 40 must pass. If it doesn't pass legislatively, it must pass by executive order. Y'all can make a difference. Pick up the telephone, call folks, say they want this. A lot of you, you're represented. Well, most people here from D.C. or the area, but we're live streamed. You may be from South Dakota. You can call your senator in South Dakota and say, I'm interested in this. I want this to happen. The second thing I want to say, and it's why I wanted to get into the cultural conversation, we have to consider joy. Mm-hmm. Everything we've been saying has been pretty heavy. We're talking about enslavement. We're talking about rape. We're talking about people being beaten. And those are heavy, heavy topics. But guess what? Enslaved people had joy. You know, they jumped the broom. They created instruments where there were no instruments. They beat pots if they couldn't beat drums. You know, they loved up on each other. They sang. They stole away. And I just think it's really, I did the closing speech for Black Graduation this year at Cal State LA, and that was my theme, is possessing the secret of joy. With all of everything else we do, we must always still be full human, fully actualized beings, and we must exhibit and embrace our joy.
All right.
We have a lot going on here, but I would like people to leave here smiling. I would like people to leave here thinking. Betty Sabraz used to always say, and I was honored to know her as a sister friend, met her by a pool one day, and with my little crazy self, I'm like, oh, spit. And I didn't say, oh, spit. I said, you Malcolm's widow. And she said, girl, sit down and have a drink. And the next thing she said to me, she said, whenever you see something good, claim it. So I'm going to repeat Betty Sabraz, find the good and claim it.
All right. Pam Howard.
I just want to just echo what everybody has stated. I'm an activist, and so everything I do is to inspire others to act. And we shared how you can act around H.R. 40. You can act. There's a film out, The Big Payback, directed by, you talk about art, directed by Erica Alexander, who was Maxine on Living Single. It chronicles two black, powerful black women, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee in regards to H.R. 40 and Robin Simmons in regards to the Evanston Reparations Initiative. It's very inspiring, powerful, educational, so you want to go to the Big Payback or Tribeca Film Festival and view that. Joy. We know that race-neutral public policy does not do anything but widen the gaps. There's all type of science around that. You cannot have regular public policy and think these gaps are going to be decreased. It's not going to happen. They're just going to continue to widen. However, on the flip side of that, we know scientifically, Citigroup came out with a study that says if you pay black folks reparations, all of America benefits economically.
Yep.
Right? So if we say no race neutral policy, why is the gap? But if you pay reparations, which is specifically to people of African descent, it benefits everybody economically. That's what Sister was talking about, how white people vote against their own interests when it comes to black people. It's even in your interest to pay black folks reparations. This is what the science, this is what economists are telling us right now. Am I right, Dr.
Marvo? You're right. Sure, you're right.
So it makes no sense. The only reason we don't have reparations is because of racist whites.
Predatory capitalism.
Enough. No, but it's still, there has to be more whites, and we're getting more allies, tremendous more allies, but that has to increase in order for there to be reparations because, again, it benefits the entire country.
All right, let's give a big round of applause to our panel. Building a culture of repair. Building a culture of repair. Remembering, having memory, not having memory erased. Knowing our history. Bob Marley said knowing our history, right? And all of those good things. I want to quickly acknowledge, we heard from Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. I understand her chief of staff's eased up in here. Lily Connie, would you please stand up, the chief of staff for Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. Give it up. She is a hard-working sister, too. Thank you so much. Also want to give a shout-out to Minister Christian Watkins. He's been working on this project with us as well. He's been coming over, working. Stand up, Minister Christian, and get your bow. All right. Brought one of my board members from IBW here, Ronald Hampton, who's one of the baddest, most prolific experts on police restructuring. Ron Hampton, stand up and take a bow. IBW board member. Want to give a shout out also to Minister Mensah, the junior, I understand. I made the mistake of coming in and said that his minister said, "Well, which one are you talking about?" And he laughed. I said, "I'm talking about the younger one." "Oh, that one." He's been very incredible to us. Give him a big round of applause for helping us out. Want to also just in general, a big round of applause for Shiloh, the historic Shiloh Baptist Church, for opening its doors to us. Thank you so much for opening your doors. And so you've heard the charge. The charge is to build a culture of repair. We've had a stimulating conversation. And Dr. Malvo said we should leave with joy. And I agree. We ought to be, you know, even in the middle of all of this stuff, we are so resilient. So when we do Kwanzaa, we do Harambe. Some of y'all know about that, right? We end with Harambe.